We are gathered tonight as part of the sort of global dimension, I think, of these weeks of thinking about the rainbow. Lots of different angles into the topic of these weeks. And one of the ways that we want to explore tonight takes particular advantage of the people to my left and my immediate left and right. And hopefully we'll take advantage of lots of you in the room as well. Some of you I know have some direct experience in our topic tonight and will be contributing, we hope, along the way. My name is Jody Kretzmann, and what we're going to do tonight is to open up a discussion that we hope will go for the next 10 days as part of the Rainbow Weeks. And that is a set of reflections on, analyses of, reactions to, strategies about the nature of race relations in the United States, and tonight particularly, in comparison with and in connection to South Africa. And we're going to take advantage of the last day or two of presence in the village of Steve DeGrucci from South Africa, who's going to be going back to Cape Town in the next month to begin serving his alternative service as a conscientious objector there for a number of years. And Joe Bart on my right, who arrived today from the South Bronx in the United States, who has traveled frequently himself to South Africa and has been involved in both in thinking both about racism in the United States and apartheid in South Africa. So we're going to take advantage of the sort of cross-cultural experiences that both of these people bring to this topic to lead us in to reflections that compare and contrast the U.S. and South Africa in particular. Let me just note at the beginning that there are always gaps and there are always particular angles when one deals particularly with racial topics that we have to be extra aware of. We are not unaware of the fact that there are three white males leading off this discussion tonight, and that brings some limitations to the kinds of perspectives that we can share with you. We just want to acknowledge that as a fact we're perfectly aware of at the beginning, and then hope that the gifts particularly and the experience of Steve and Joe can be taken for all that it has to teach us. Both Steve and Joe, as I said, have had intensive experiences in their native countries, the U.S. and South Africa, and then also quite extensive experiences in the country that is not theirs. So we want to start with a brief kind of laying out for you of their own impressions of those cross-cultural, cross-national kinds of experiences. Then we'll ask them to address a couple of other issues and open it up, hopefully, for participation from everybody for most of the next hour. Who wants to start? Steve? You?
In terms of just biographical details, I'm a fourth generation South African. And to a large extent, who I am has been shaped by my parents' involvement in the church, and particularly that section of the South African church in its criticisms of apartheid. I've lived most of my life since the beginning of high school in Cape Town, South Africa, where I went through school at not only an all-white school, but an all-male school too. And then went on to University of Cape Town, where I finished 6 years study in theology. And I've just been accepted as a conscientious objector and will be doing alternative service as hopefully a hospital chaplain for the next while. So I'm very much a South African. I know a number of people have often asked me, when did I go to South Africa or whatever, but that's where I'm from. And I'm very committed to the country and to the liberation struggle in that country. My awareness of America goes back to the fact that I learned to speak English in America. My father studied at Chicago Theological Seminary in 1964, And I was a young kid just learning to speak, and I came, returned home speaking my first words with an American twang. I then returned with my family in 1977. My father was in sabbatical in the Mennonite community in Kansas, and I got a chance to see a different side of America to what I'd seen on the TVs and the movies beforehand. And then I've just spent a year in New York City as a student at Union Theological Seminary, and found that an interesting experience and an eye-opener into not only the student community, but also the New York community. And apart from that, I have an aunt and uncle on my father's side who live in Atlanta, Georgia, and an aunt and uncle on my mother's side who live in Erie, Pennsylvania, and both of them are involved in transnational corporations that have dealings with South Africa. So I feel pretty much that if I had another place in the world, it would be America. And I feel that I've had some kind of exposure and experience with the United States.
George, you want to lay your experience out for just a moment, and then we'll ask a couple of joint questions to get the stuff going here.
I could, my own history is as much domestic to the United States as Steve's is to South Africa. My work has been involved in working in the church, and especially in various aspects of ministry of the church in the inner city and various aspects of justice and particularly anti-racism work in the United States for 25 years of ordination and various kinds of issues. And one of the most dramatic experiences of my life was during the 70s to make two treks, one to spend some time traveling through Latin America for a year, and then later in the same decade to spend 6 months in South Africa, and to especially in the experience within South Africa to do a lot of sharing and learning, and especially comparing of the issues in terms of the racism and of the struggle against racism in South Africa and in the United States. And rather than saying more personal, just the impact of the comparison between the two was for me really laid on me when I was in South Africa and somebody played for me a record of Robert Kennedy making a speech at the University of Cape Town, where Steve's father teaches, in 1967, which was the year before he was assassinated, is that right?
Yes.
I hope it wasn't the year after. It was somewhere in there. And he introduced a speech to the graduates of the University of Cape Town by saying, "I'm really happy to speak to you tonight out of the context, and in the context rather, of a country that that was first settled by the Dutch, and that had from the moment they came to those Dutch people came to the soil to that country had and still have today unfriendly relationships with the natives that they met." Who had an expansion into the frontier, which was marked by continuous battles of and assassinations and of creating a reservations for the native people, and at the end of that trek, discovered gold, which changed the entire history of the country, and the entire people listening, in the context of South Africa, thought he was talking about South Africa, and had their minds blown when he said, "I just gave you a brief history of the United States." The comparison of the two histories, for me, was a tremendous experience to come back home to the United States after that, continue the work of struggling against racism in the United States, having been informed by almost having seen myself in a mirror. Amazing.
Okay, so that's the cross-cultural sort of personal biography that we've got, a pair of them out here on the table. Thought we would ask each of Steve and Joe to respond briefly to two questions and then throw it wide open. The questions being, number one, how they see the predominant issues at this particular time in the history, particularly of race relations, but in the broader public moment of their respective countries. And they'll each do that, and then I'll ask them to be very brief in identifying a couple of the differences between the United States and South Africa. So we'll get some both some comparisons and some contrasts out on the table, and then we'll open it up. Steve, how do you see the major questions on the public agenda, the major issues in South Africa?
I think the easiest way to figure that one out is, rather than making some kind of academic decision from on top, is to ask the question, what are people fighting for and against in South Africa? I think racism is obviously the most obvious one that comes across in TV and speaking to people. And not just the kind of racism where people can't sit next to each other on park benches, or people don't like to live in the same neighborhoods as others, but racism, a definition I heard Jody give, which is privilege and power. It's a combination of privilege and power in the political setup, in the constitution, in the legal system, and in the economic system. But allied very strongly with that, and often what's forgotten in most kinds of fleeting analyses of South Africa, is the fact that the South African situation has escalated into a civil war. And that means that militarism, not just racism, but now the use of the military to uphold law and order, in inverted commas, and to enforce racism beyond the police power that was needed to do it. In other words, a move from just oppression to repression has made militarism a big issue. And certainly within the white community, there's a tremendous amount of organizing against what we call conscription, which I think is similar to the draft. All white men are called up for 2 years when they leave high school. And South Africa has the ability to have 500,000 able-bodied men under arms, I think, in a period of a week, in terms of its call-up system. So militarism is a big thing. And I think the other issue that's often at the back of a number of agendas is the fact that the country, for most people in the country, are poor. A lot due to unemployment, a lot due to poverty, but mostly due to the system. Capitalist imperialism in South Africa, which began with the British and the discovery of gold and diamonds that was mentioned here, and the creation of labor reserves and the pushing of people off the land to become labor units. And the whole migrant labor system has led to a tremendous amount of poverty and social dislocation. And certainly, I know the sanctions debate has raised the whole question of unemployment and poverty, but I think the trick in South Africa is to remember that even employment doesn't break the poverty cycle in the system of South Africa. So I would hold out those three issues: racism, militarism, and poverty. Now, the way they put together and the ingredients are all, you know, they change from day to day. I remarked to somebody over supper that a lecture of ours on contemporary politics in South Africa was inadvertently pronounced temporary politics in South Africa. And I think contemporary and temporary is pretty much the word for South Africa. And any one of those ingredients can take the move. And some even argue today that, in fact, racism is not the primary issue of South Africa, but is rather class, the poverty issue, or even militarism, the fact that the military control the country now, and that we're living in a military state of martial law.
Okay, Steve.
About as succinct as I could get.
Joe, same question.
It would be fascinating if we had the time to have just everyone here just list all of the many issues, because I think we have a great skill in the United States to divide up the tremendous number of issues that we have. Ranging from all kinds of various listed of issues, and often they get very disconnected. But it would be my opinion that if the listing of the major issues would probably be the very same three that Steve listed, race, economics, and military, maybe from a wholly different kind of base and a different way in which they're applied. The military, for example, within South Africa is enforcing things within, and the military is a much more global kind of emphasis within from the United States outward. But probably the most important thing has to do with that, as well as all the other issues that we might list, is their interconnectedness. And I don't know if that would be the same for you, Steve, within South Africa, as where you see them interconnected. And maybe maybe probably the example of what happened in also in the 60s with Martin Luther King, of seeing their interconnectedness, and as having raised up as the civil rights movement was going on. And it was in 1967 also that he raised up the connection between the war in Vietnam and the battle against racism in the United States, and connected them economically. That was a tremendous move for Martin Luther King and for the entire civil rights movement, and moved many of us to an entire new position of understanding what was happening in the United States, and that there would be many of us who would say, and I've heard Bishop Herzl among others say it time and time again, that it is no accident that within a year after which he said that Martin Luther King was killed. The interconnection of the three basic issues of racism, economics, and the military in the United States. One other thing about that is another record that I heard in South Africa, besides the Robert Kennedy one, is a record of Martin Luther King. You know, in South Africa, it's easy to get something banned. If it goes outside the government's what's permitted, you can have you put something out in the morning, and by evening it's illegal to sell it, read it, or have it in existence. And so they have a style of, one of the ways of getting something dispersed throughout the country before it gets banned is to have it all prepared for distribution, so that it gets, the distribution begins on Friday night at 5 o'clock, and they can get it distributed through the entire country before Monday morning at 9 o'clock, when the banning comes. And that happened, there was a speech that Martin King made, and Will, you might remember when it was made, sometime in the mid-60s, to the Episcopal Peace Conference in Washington, D.C., and the speech was called Sleeping Through a Revolution. And it was one of the speeches where he was beginning to make those connections, and he used the illustration, the old story of Rip Van Winkle, waking up when the revolution was over, and it was his challenge to not sleep through the revolution. Well, there was a White, Reverend White, is that his name? I'm trying to remember, the man who got several thousand of those made and distributed on Friday. The distribution began on Friday night, and by Monday morning they were banned, but by that time they had been distributed completely through South Africa. And when I got there in 77, there were still these little old scratchy records of Martin Luther King playing Sleeping Through Revolution, who really began there also. I began to hear through people's interpretation of that, and they're going on from that, the same kind of unification of military, racism, and economics as the unification of the predominant issues. Once again, seeing in a mirror of the two countries in relationship to each other.
Remarkable agreement so far. I suspect there will be some additions to the list or some disagreements with the list when we open it up in a moment. Let me ask you the flip side of the question, though, and have you comment briefly on how you see the major differences between apartheid in South Africa and racism in the United States. Steve, you want to start that?
Yeah. I think the numbers are different. I mean, if we start there, and that makes an awful difference. The figures briefly for South Africa are about 28 million blacks to 5 million whites, and then government-defined groups between that, coloured and Indian, who make up about 2 million together. And that means that if you're talking ethnic minorities in South Africa, to use American language, you're talking the whites who are in power. And that has a very perverse kind of outworking in South Africa, because for the government, the blacks will be made up of countless minority tribal groupings when they want it to be, and will be made up of a massive group of blacks when they wanted to be as well. And Buerta, in the same speech, can talk about the fact that we can't have one person, one vote, because all the blacks will gang up against all the whites. And then in the very next sentence we'll say, but one of the reasons white must stay in South Africa is to keep the different black tribes apart. And you sit there wondering whether blacks are all one, or are, in fact, this whole group. But there's a numbers game there, and I think the tribal differences and the tensions created by tribal politics fostered by the government. I think a second thing is that we have a liberation project in South Africa. There's a struggle going on. People in the streets are fighting. They estimate about 400 armed ANC cadres in the country. Joe was just saying that he read in the newspaper or heard on the radio on Sunday that the South African Council of Churches, and this is news to me, I mean, being up in Holden Village, you don't hear this, but the SACC had just said that it stood behind the armed struggle in South Africa.
Affirmed armed resistance.
Affirmed armed resistance. Now, that's very different to the National Council of Churches in the United States. But there's a liberation project underway, and people know about it, people are aware of it, people are not duped by half measures, and the conflict is in, I was going to say black and white, but maybe I'll say red and yellow. I mean, it's in two stark colors, contrasted, in real dark tension, and you're either for the one side or for the other. There's no in-between position. And I think that's different from what I've picked up in the United States. I mean, I think there's a lot of tension about which party should we support? Should there be a third party? Should we all get in the Democrats? What about black Republicans? What about... I mean, it just seems a different kind of setup here. I think a third difference is simply that racism and apartheid are supported by law in South Africa, whereas in the United States that's not the case. So that we have both a de jure and a de facto racism in South Africa. And we don't have a Supreme Court that would uphold the challenges to it in terms of racism, whatever. The courts are there basically to enforce racism. And that makes it very different in terms of something like nonviolent struggle. Because you can't take anything to the Supreme Court. And in fact, you're not necessarily going to end up in court if you get arrested. You might just be dead or detained, which may be something that happens in the United States too. But it's much more condoned by the system in South Africa. I would say that those three, actually, I mean, sure, there are lots that we could go on and list them, but I think those are three that I sense as different.
Joe, how would you respond to that? And then we'll open it up.
I'd respond, I suppose, in the same way that we have been responding to each other. We are the opposite sides of the same coin, and have very much, from two different perspectives, come to a lot of similar conclusions. And I hope that whatever there is from the group can bring some differences to what we're saying. I certainly agree that I would put them maybe in the same numerical order, but the biggest difference is the clarity of the struggle in South Africa versus the confusion and diffusion of the struggle here in the United States from the predominant white political point of view. It is so easy in the United States to say South Africa is evil and we're making progress against racism in the United States. And from the predominant view within the United States that we are somehow in the process of making progress, of solving the problems, and Reagan has said that basically the racial problems in the United States have been solved, and that there's nothing, and that there's still some, and I think that is sort of a predominant view, and even within the, even where that is not the view, the clarity is still not there in the United States, in the black and other people of color communities, there is a diffusion about who is the leaders, what are the issues, how it will be resolved. You may have trouble taking it to the courts. We have a president who can make sure that for the next year, the Supreme Court will keep leading us away from the achievements that have been made. So there's a different totally different place where the struggle is at here in the United States. And it's one in which there's a tremendous amount of diffusion and confusion about defining where that struggle is at. To the extent that it is clear, it is certainly clear, I believe, to me it seems clearer and clearer that the emphasis upon economic analysis and seeing racism through an economic eyes is the way in which certainly the analysis and the struggle within the cities that is taking us to seeing the struggle for racial justice being placed in the economic positions. One other thing about the difference is the numbers thing. Somehow, I suppose the South African government is in one way really encouraged by the fact that our reservation system worked, and that we were able to put all the natives of the United States on reservations, and the fact that that just simply is not going to work in the United States. I don't think, rather in South Africa, the South African government has not caught up with. But we still get away with calling people of color in the United States minorities. And I think you're really right about that. But one of the things that visiting and studying and reflecting on South Africa has helped me to do is to not just see the comparison between the South Africa and the United States, but the comparison between South Africa and the global perspective. That what the United States participates in is something of a global apartheid. And that we are able to call ourselves the majority and people of the color minority so long as we keep ourselves within a national analysis. And as long as we are able, even in our church boards, to keep a domestic mission and a world mission and keep them separate from each other and keep the ideologies separate from each other, and to not be able to see that that when you look from a global perspective, the percentages are even the same as South Africa. Mm. That is just that a global apartheid, so that even the differences that look so very, very different from within the United States, if we're forced to drop our nationalistic curtains and our pretense about being the majority and people of color and minority fall away, and once again a difference becomes a similarity again for me.
Well, thanks to both. Let's open it up. There's a sense in which both Steve and Joe have been talking in headlines here, and let's see where it is that you all want to take this. Will, do you have anything you want to add at this point, or you want to get in as the conversation goes at some point here? What area you want to push here, Bruce?
I just have a question. Steve, a couple of weeks ago, headlines that the church in South Africa was split. Could you explain what that is? That apparently there was a conservative splinter group that wanted to have more, or felt that the church was too liberal. At least that's what our headlines were saying here, and that they wanted the Dutch Reformed Church to be more supportive, more militaristic in favor of apartheid. What's the effect of it?
You know, the church thing in South Africa is just so vast. The church in South Africa is not the Dutch Reformed Church at all. And, I mean, the Dutch Reformed Church is, the white Dutch Reformed Church is about 1.5 million people. But the Anglican Church is 2 million, the Methodists are 2 million, the Catholics are 2 million, the Presbyterians are just under 1 million, Congregationalists are just under 1 million, the Baptists are just under 1 million. I mean, there are a lot of denominations. And a few right-wing splitting off the white Dutch Reformed Church is a non-issue. I mean, it really is a non-issue. I mean, the bigger issue is, as far as I can see it, is those people who belong to the mainline churches, the Methodist, Catholic, Presbyterian, Congregationalist, whites, who are becoming more conservative. That's more of a worry. But a few people splitting off the Dutch Reformed Church is hardly an issue. I mean, that's my feeling. It makes a lot of news here in America because, for some strange reason, Americans think that that's big news. I mean, I'm not picking up on you on this, but I think it's an interesting perception. So many people ask me if I'm Dutch Reformed, and it's like me thinking that everybody in America is Congregationalist because the Puritans in New England were Congregationalists. I mean, it's the same dynamic. Does that answer?
Well, yeah, I guess a question in addition to that is that at least it's been my perception that the power base within the country lay within the Dutch Reformed Church. Is that true or is that not true?
Yeah, that's, I mean, that there is that kind of historical connection between the two. But the church split is really secondary to the party split. You see, up until 1982, the party and the church consisted of the same people. Mm. 1982, the party split. And it's only a matter of time before the church split. And all that's happening is that as the Nationalist Party stayed in power and the Conservatives broke away to form their own party, those who adhered to the Nationalist Party got control of the Dutch Reformed Church. But there are those now who belong to the Conservative Party inside the Dutch Reformed Church who don't like the fact that the Dutch Reformed Church is supporting the government and want a more right-wing opposition. So they're going to come off. But the split has already happened politically in 1982.
What's the distribution of colored, black, Indian, Asian population?
In terms of?
In what you said, there were about 1.5 million Dutch Reformed, 2 million Catholic, 2 million, and so forth. What kind of, what is the black or colored church of? You read Bishop Tutu, that's the church of...
That's the Anglican church. The church in South Africa is 88% black. That's across all the denominations. My own church, the Congregational Church, is 94% black.
I see.
One of the impressions created because of the missionary ethos is that the church is white. But in fact, the church is predominantly black. So Archbishop Desmond Tutu is Archbishop of the Anglican Church, which is 2 million people.
Of which, how many are white and how many black?
About 80% black.
80%?
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Of black.
And
maybe more than 80% of the Anglican.
The Presbyterian Church is the only what are called mainline denominations that's more whites than blacks. And it makes it almost as conservative at some levels as the white Dutch Reformed Church. But if you are interested in all these dynamics, I gave an hour-long presentation on the church in South Africa that is on tape, and it might be worth it. Because we could go, I mean, I could talk for half.
It is very helpful. I really do recommend that route, because Steve did spend an hour on it. It's a very helpful map to the church life in South Africa that he laid out. How about this question of the comparison between the United States and South Africa? I mean, the most striking thing about what both Steve and Joe were saying, it seems to me, is that they were basically saying there that the similarities were much more striking than the differences. What sort of reaction does that raise here? Do you have somebody from it? Yeah.
Well, I was in South Africa in 83, and I've been running around giving slide presentations about South Africa, showing slides of Soweto and all over Iowa and Illinois. And I was just recently called to a church in Cabrini Green in Chicago. And I had to go to a teenager's home.
This is a large public housing project,
yes,
in Chicago,
Green,
all black.
I called the mother and told her I was coming over. And she said, I needed to talk to her. She said, okay. So went over, had to walk up 10 flights of stairs. I got up there, and I was sitting in her living room, and I was thinking, I was talking about all of these inequities in South Africa, and right here, it was really, really something. I was just sitting there, I said, this is worse than Soweto. If I showed this lady slides of Soweto, she would say, what's the problem? She would. I showed her slides of those matchbox houses, she would say, what's the problem? So I'm really glad to have you, you know, so I'm glad to hear you put that about the similarities, because it's the same. It really is. Just the same.
Other reactions? Thank you, Maxine, for that.
Maybe Joe and Steve could just comment. Are these similarities Not the differences, no. Are these similarities accidental? Are they aberrations, you know, historical aberrations? Or are they contrived? And if so, in your opinion, when did this evil conspiracy begin? That would be the first question. Now, my second question, of course, comes out of an agreement with where you've been at, up to this point. But I think that out of that analysis, we ought to try and just talk a little bit about the future. You know, do a little crystal balling. You know, both about South Africa and about the United States. Because somehow I think that the similarities are going to become much more of a reality in the minds and in the eyes of both countries, probably within the decade. That's my own feeling at this point. But the first question is kind of a prelude, I think, to that kind of a discussion. Would you agree or would you not agree?
Well, I think that both of them are good examples of, how can I put it? I mean, it's so difficult to talk about the reasons why they ended up the same. I think the history of colonization is pretty similar to that. I think the history of capitalist penetration of both is the same. The search for the land and then the discovery of minerals and the need for high technology and labor units. I think economically the two countries are pretty similar, and I think that's why they end up pretty much the same. I was just recently in the Dominican Republic and visited a Haitian Bate. There's no apartheid in the Dominican Republic. There's just pure capitalism, and that looked just like South Africa. And I'm starting to wonder whether it's not the economic systems that set the agenda rather than the political ideology that people put on top of that and cover
exactly.
it up. Well, that's my feeling.
Presupposes some discussions and some analysis, not to dismiss, the notion of race and racism, but is race and racism, at the base of the problem? I think that we've got to continue to battle that out in much the same way as Pan-Africanists like myself, debate the qualitative differences between the slave experience and the colonial experience. How both of them worked equally as well, when it comes to the raping and the pillaging and the destruction, of a culture, and a people. Just an unbelievable and uncanny amount of success. But yet they are different. The colonial, at least from the analysis of black people of African descent, the colonial experience and the slave experience are different. And even when one does race analysis, you can come up with some differences. But where do the similarities begin? And how do we get to the bottom of it? Is it because they're black? We're black, or is it because of something else? And that's that's what I'm probing. Now, I realize what I'm asking, is simply, I'm affirming the right of three white males, to lead this discussion, because, you ought to know the problem much better than we do. I mean that. I'm not trying to be funny or pejorative about that, but we're talking about the problem, and our argument has always been that that the blacks, in South Africa is not the problem. Never were, And neither are persons of color in this country the problem.
Does the Good Samaritan start?
Maybe. I don't know. What did you say?
Is it the Good Samaritan?
Some reference
to
the Joe, you have any response?
I'd like to, but I think I'd like to hear some
others
from
yeah.
the others first.
Anybody else?
Alden, yeah.
Several comments. From the point of view of being involved in economics and teaching it, it's an economic history is my main thing for years. I've also published stuff that was put out by the in Ghana, in the main economic journal on the development of their country. I've been involved in this stuff. To me, it's just so pure and simple all my life to see you've got so many investments, you've got a return on it, and the people, no matter who they're owning or what facilities or crops or land, their life is coming back on how much are they making on that investment, and they live it and they drive it. And you just see this unfolding over the centuries. So to me, there's just no question about that. That's the root and the beginning of what's happening. And then here's something coming around from a different direction. What's happening in this country, which allows, put it this way, the time is moving where more and more groups can come together to stop the apartheid there, at the same time strengthen against racism in this country. And I remember Julianne Malveaux, a black economics professor, a woman in San Francisco, gave a talk at Berkeley one time pointing out that the the mortality of children, the birth rate in the South African, the black community, is one of the worst in the world. And just pointing out to an American audience the extreme destructiveness that's going on every day, every week in South Africa, and therefore the African National Congress and other groups have to fight back now in every way they can. That's where it is. It's not a matter of can we all live in peace. She was trying to hit this hard for an American audience in Berkeley. That's one aspect. Another is where the move to start all this the disinvestment, get the companies out of South Africa. Well, what I'm bringing out is that in Berkeley, there was a lot of student demonstrations. Then some of the people were on campus and also members of trade unions, like the teachers union. And the county sent the labor council for, like Alameda, 140 some locals. They came together in a joint effort, and there were mass meetings and then big official meetings on campus of thousands of people, and all the labor leaders were in there as part of that demand the university to disinvest. So this is, you all know about a lot of this, but I'm pointing to how the student movements, the community movements, the trade union groups were coming together in this effort. And then remember how, I guess you've all heard, the longshoremen refused to unload ships with African cargo, and they were breaking their own contracts, but they went against it. And then there was all kinds of slowdown and agitation, even though the courts and the judges came down and forced them to unload. Well, I was on some of those picket lines because I'm in the teachers' union, and also the Alameda Central Labor Council. So I'm just telling what we saw. So this San Francisco Bay Area, whether it's San Francisco or Oakland, there's these combinations of groups now to drive on these problems.
That's hopeful. Thank
you. That's the thing to build on, this combination of the church groups and the leadership of the churches and the trade unions and then the rest of the students, you know, starting to move together, be on the picket lines together.
Contribution to question about crystal balling, other kinds of reactions. Gary, you've had some South Africa experience yourself. Do you want to leak in also?
Well,
thought about this economics and racism question. I think, haven't you?
I agree. I guess it's great. I didn't spend a lot of time in South Africa, only about 2.5 weeks, Jenny and I. But I think the economic situation is what really drives things. One of the things I think we're going to see more in the future is in the United States we have a fairly significant economic problem coming up. Mm-hmm. You know, in world competition, we aren't what we used to be, or perhaps we had a monopoly position is a better way to say it. And so what we're seeing now is a tremendous shift in, you know, in power base to Asia. Just, it's going to be very significant. It's going to be hard on all of us, you know, black, white, yellow, whatever color we are in the United States, and I think that same thing is true in South Africa. I guess that's probably similar. I agree with what's been said that economics is what drives things. And I think that that's going to be one of the, I think there's favorable things happening, but one of the unfavorable things happening is to these countries is loss of economic power, which we will feel very painfully, or are just starting to feel about now.
It's interesting. I don't think that we could have had a discussion on racism anywhere in the United States 10 years ago where we would have had as much agreement as we've had in the last 15 or 20 minutes on the centrality of questions of economics. It's a huge move that we're sort of experiencing and ratifying here this evening. You want to leap in?
It seems to me that the centrality of economics is accurate, but it seems to me also that centrality of economics has led up, I mean, given that, and given the kind of economic situations that this country finds itself moving towards, the problem, one of the other major issues that they talked about, which is militarism, becomes increasingly important because in this country it has been military expenditure and increasing emphasis on the military, which has been seen as the solution to the economic problems, a way to postpone an inevitability. And if we continue that way, we end up with something that supposedly we have protected ourselves against constitutionally.
Sure. Over and over again, it seems easier to argue, in fact, the foreign policy questions than it is particularly with people who work in defense plants, for instance,
exactly.
To argue the,
exactly.
The economic questions.
That's right. When the USS Frigate, what's the name of that ship?
Stark.
Was shelled, and I think it was 37 sailors.
Yes.
Lost their lives in the Gulf. One of the things that I learned this, of course, as a result of going through a lot of pain, you know, those evenings when we were trying to figure out, what was trying to do to us when he started to, you know, do his analysis on how we were inextricably linked to the Vietnamese question, and that the Vietnamese question had a lot more devastation for us than we might imagine, and it had nothing to do with turning off our white comrades, to the civil rights movement by meddling around in war issues. And of course, we're still told by State Department people and by some liberal whites, that we have no expertise in these areas. Maybe we don't, and we might be blessed because we don't. But when you count the 37 sailors, and I counted them, I counted all 37 of them, seven of them at first, and then I went to DeLauer's book newsstand. To find something with the photographs of these sailors. I knew that would be around someplace because you can't tell much from names these days. If a sailor named Hertzfeld gets his name on the list, there's no way to tell what he was other than German. But on that ship, which belonged to what has been and what I believe still is the most racist military unit in the United States of America, black sailors died far out of proportion to our numbers in this country. Now, when I looked at that, and I started making notes to myself, I said, now, is that a race problem? Or what is it? Are these sailors on the ship and got killed because they were black? Or were they on the ship and got killed because they couldn't find jobs?
Because they were black.
Because they were black. And what kind of analysis, you know, does that force out of us when these same ships, you know, might be sent somewhere in the vicinity of the Horn of Africa for
protect our economic interests.
To protect our economic interests. Now, people say, my God, he's being prematurely alarmist. One of the big debates now, you know, following the attack on that ship, you know, by our friends, you know, is to flag every tanker, you know, in the, you know, the, out there with, you know, put our flags on them. And I guess it was Peter Jennings, you know, made a terrible mistake, but told the truth by saying, we're about to put our flags on the ships in order to protect American bankers, tankers.
Marion, what's that we've got?
Jenny, we've got the same bizarre situation developing in South Africa. They just recently started a new, I don't know what you call them in modern terms, legion, whatever, of constables who can be trained for 3 weeks and would be paid for that training. And just exactly what we were saying is, because of the massive unemployment, there's just no other jobs for black people. And in the first week of them opening this training course, they had over 500,000 applications for jobs in the South African Defence Force. And what those constables do is they're armed and sent into the townships to actually shoot their neighbours, basically, shoot their neighbours' children. And it's because of the unemployment that they are applying for those jobs. There's no other jobs for them.
Well, we're about the business of making sure that we understand or try to understand in a new kind of way the interrelationship between economics and racism. I just want to emphasize the fact that the people who do not want to be seen as racist are very happy to see an economic analysis and see it wasn't, you know, love the joke, for example, that that Gregory used to say about identifying Hyde Park, Chicago, as the place where black and white stand hand in hand, shoulder to shoulder against the poor. You know, and so that somehow it can be moved away from this from the thing of racism, and then those who do not want to, and then by the way you can keep it if you go to one side you can hold on to your privilege if you can make sure that if Will and I are both millionaires, you know, and if we join hands and not be racist about it, then we can still go on being millionaires and not have to look at and seeing how much our millions are oppressing people. But then there was also the shifting to the other side of wanting to deny the economic oppression, you know, and even willing to tolerate some of the accusations of racism. It was Will who told me 22 years ago, one of the oldest jokes within the black community, which was everybody knew, but folks in the white community had not heard. And that is, what do you call a black man who has made $1 million and who has a big house that's worth $1 million and has a Cadillac and a Rolls Royce and a PhD and all the success symbols in the world? And the answer to the joke is you call him nigger. And that is to say that you never, ever, with an economic analysis, can use an economic analysis in order to avoid the fact that economics and racism are intertwined, and the Howard Beaches and all of the stories that just continue to come up again and again and again and again will not go away just because you come up with a good economic analysis. So somehow, I don't understand, and I'm not claiming to understand the interrelationship between the two, but I also don't want to be forced to choose one over the other as somehow being able to say I solved the one I didn't choose.
We have a dual project that's being set here for the next 10 days. A couple of more comments and we'll close the evening, but let's just remind ourselves that what we're doing here is setting a project and a series of discussions for the next 10 days. One is to understand more deeply the linkage between race and economics, and the second is to pursue some kinds of approaches that seem to carry hope in them. A couple of comments. Ingrid?
That's a question. I cannot understand the Reagan family policies on family. My gut reaction to every single time Reagan comes out with anything about family, including abortion rights, women's control of their bodies, daycare, anything about reproductive rights or raising of children, every time anything comes out of the administration, my gut reaction is that's based on racism. But it's clearly, in my mind, not based on economics. I don't understand where, I think economics must play a role in that, but I just don't get it. Why does Reagan believe what he believes about family?
Now you're entered a whole different realm.
That's another way, hang on a minute, because we do have to bring it. We are watching the clock at this place here. Let's just have another. Ingrid, can you open this question up for further discussion later on?
We can talk about it sometime.
Okay. That's a promise.
Well, yes. What I was going to say reflects on a lot of what she said and what we talked about earlier, and that I think economic analysis is central, but economics does not stand like a tower alone in a wilderness.
Thank you.
It stands, in fact, buttressed by a great deal of contrived, and not necessarily artificial, but contrived conscious ideologies. And these ideologies are designed to support that economic structure. Now, whether they preceded or succeeded in its origin is not necessarily relevant. They are adapted to buttress that economic existence. And that's why racism, you know, becomes an ideological problem as well as an economic problem.
Well, that's, you know, that's a part of what I would hope we could hold in tension, you know, and it's, I got strong regrets about not being around, you know, for the 10 days. Maybe come one of those Holden sayings, be near the pot, you know, that's the end of the end of the rainbow. You can't even talk rainbow without talking, you know, something that has to do with economics. But the problem, and I just want to say this, you know, not as any kind of a final word, that every time the question of South Africa, you know, comes up here at this point, you know, the new solution to the problem, you know, is divestment. The new solution to the problem, you know, is to affect, you know, the economic balance. The new solution to the problem is the final solution to the problem. And I know that economics is at the base, but then Joe understands, you know, that I also know that there's something fundamentally sick, you know, about the way we perceive, you know, the differences which are gifts of the Creator. And I guess I just want to illustrate that very quickly. I would have loved to have seen Reagan take Nakasone on another subject. I think that the Japanese, you know, sell us out, you know, in the South African situation. You know, I would have loved to have seen Reagan do something other than declare war on Japan, the way he does, you know, primarily because, you know, they're smart enough to rip off, you know, the U.S. economically and, you know,
smart enough to play our game against us.
Precisely. It's called computer karate, you know, among other kinds of games that people play. But you see, Asians, you know, because of this new mania, you know, Asians are beaten to death on the streets of Detroit. And it has, you know, and I submit that it has nothing to do with economics, but it has to do with the slant of their eyes, the texture of their skin, you know, and their size, and how they might speak, you know, like they can't get the hell out of things the way, you know, the way some of us think we can. It's a complex problem, and as I say, you know, there is no simple analysis, but Holden's a place where we, you know, get at the hard questions and struggle with them.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. You got 2 seconds, Alden? Okay.
Yeah. It just leaves something for discussion later, and that is this whole question that I'm here on, and they gave a paper here in Europe recently, the economics of climate stabilization, meaning that the third world countries where the forests grow the fastest and our future lies, industrial countries have to support them, or we've all had it, and that whole approach has never been put forward before in an official paper. It's in the proceedings and conference, so it's raising a new question that's coming down on us. That's what we do.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you. This is a setting of an agenda. We are at the beginning of a process, we're at the beginning of a week, and we're at the beginning of a 2-week set of discussions here. Will not be with us for the whole time, but more people will be coming in, and Steve particularly, I think, has been raising these questions for the last 3 or 4 weeks at Holden, along with Marion, and this may be one of the last times we get to thank you all for all that you brought to the Holden community. Thank you all for late night energy. Appreciate it.